Hello and welcome to Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. Readings are selected from Bloomberg, Forbes, Fortune, CNBC, and other financial publications. I'm listener-supported SunSounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. This article is posted to AOL.com. The title, Taxes. IRS waives penalty for taxpayers with tax bills from 2020 and 2021. This was posted by Rhonda Lee on January 13, 2024. Nearly 5 million taxpayers who have unpaid tax bills from 2020 and 2021 will have almost $1 billion in penalty fees waived by the Internal Revenue Service. The IRS announced penalty relief in December for taxpayers who had outstanding tax bills but were not sent automated collection reminder notices during the pandemic. Though the notices did not go out in 2020 and 2021, the failure to pay penalty accrued for taxpayers who did not fully pay their bills. As the IRS has been preparing to return to normal collection mailings, we have been concerned about taxpayers who haven't heard from us in a while suddenly getting a larger tax bill. The IRS should be looking out for taxpayers, and this penalty relief is a common sense approach to help people in this situation, IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel said in a statement. We're taking other steps to help taxpayers with past due bills, and we have options to help people struggling to pay, he said. The mailed IRS notices, which should start hitting mailboxes this month, outline the amount of penalty relief received. Taxpayers can also check IRS.gov to access their tax transcripts and records. The penalty relief is automatic for taxpayers who owe back taxes, though it's limited to tax bills of $100,000 or less, Rob Seltzer, a certified public accountant at Seltzer Business Management, told Yahoo Finance. If a taxpayer already paid the penalty before the relief was announced, they will automatically be refunded, he added. If the taxpayer is not eligible for this relief, the IRS recommends applying for relief under the first-time abate program. Another thing impacted taxpayers need to consider is interest, which the IRS did not waive. While penalties can be the larger amount, there will still be interest due on the outstanding balance until paid in full, Janet Lee Crotchman, a certified public accountant, told Yahoo Finance. Taxpayers should talk to their tax professional if they have questions on the penalty waiver or interest. Taxpayers should also be aware of scammers pretending to be the IRS. The IRS will be sending letters, not emails or texts, and the IRS will not ask for payment via gift cards, Lawrence Pahn, a CPA at Pahn and Associates, told Yahoo Finance. Any payments to the IRS can be made by check to the address on the letter or can be paid electronically to the IRS from your bank account or using a credit or debit card. Rhonda Lee is a personal finance senior reporter for Yahoo Finance and an attorney with experience in law, insurance, education, and government. And again, the title of that, Taxes, IRS Waives Penalty for Taxpayer with Tax Bills from 2020 to 2021. This article is posted to Reuters. Title is Kroger Albertsons Need More Time to Close on $25 billion Proposed Merger. This was posted on January 15, 2023. Grocers Kroger and Albertsons said on Monday that they plan to close the proposed $24.6 billion merger in the first half of Kroger's fiscal 2024 year instead of early 2024. The merger, first announced in October 2022, has drawn the ire of U.S. lawmakers and an investigation by the Federal Trade Commission due to antitrust concerns, with worries piling up that the deal would lead to higher prices for consumers, store closures, and the loss of jobs. In light of our continuing dialogue with the regulators, we are updating our anticipated closure timeline, the companies said in a statement. In 2023, the first half of Kroger's fiscal year ended August 12th. Kroger said it will invest $500 million to reduce prices and $1.3 billion to enhance customer experience. The companies said they remained in active and ongoing dialogue with the Federal Trade Commission and individual state attorneys general regarding their proposed merger and divestiture plan. Kroger, which is the biggest grocer in the United States by revenue, proposed to divest over 400 stores and 8 distribution centers to C&S Wholesale Grocers. Last year, it said it may need to shed an additional 237 stores to gain regulatory approval. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, Ford Cuts Workforce, Making Electric F-150s on Weak Demand. This follows December news that 2024 production would be halved, carmaker adding third shift to make more Broncos, more Rangers. This was written by Keith Naughton, posted on Friday, January 19, 2024. Ford Motor Company said that it would reduce the number of workers making its F-150 Lightning truck as demand for electric vehicles continues to weaken. About 1,400 employees will be impacted as the Rouge Electric Vehicle Center transitions to one shift beginning April 1st, the Dearborn, Michigan-based automaker said Friday in a statement. The company said it expects continued growth in global EV sales in 2024, though it will be less than anticipated. Last month, Bloomberg reported that Ford would cut production goals for the F-150 EV in half this year. In a sign that traditional gasoline-powered vehicle demand remains strong, Ford also said it was hiring nearly 900 new employees and adding 700 employees from its Rouge complex for a third shift at its Michigan assembly plant. This will allow the automaker to increase production of Bronco and Bronco Raptor sport vehicle, utility vehicles, and Ranger Raptor pickup trucks. Ford shares fell 0.8% to $10.90 as of 9:38 a.m. in New York on Friday the 19th. Ford said it is balancing production to meet customer demand. Chief Executive Officer Jim Farley said the company still sees a bright future for EVs for specific customers. American car buyers have cooled on EVs, balking at the high prices and a spotty charging infrastructure. Ford has responded by repeatedly cutting production of the F-150 Lightning, its signature EV, and the Mustang Mach-E it builds in Mexico. The automaker also downsized by nearly half a battery plant it is building in Michigan and is delaying plans for a battery plant in Kentucky as it pushes back $12 billion in planned spending on electric vehicles. It's pretty clear there have been some slowdowns in EV adoption, David Lefkowitz, head of consumer equities for UBS Global Wealth Management, said on Bloomberg Television Friday. We're getting to the part of the market where it takes a little more effort to penetrate the market, he said. UBS has forecast just 11% sales growth in the U.S. EV market this year, down from 47% last year, and 60% growth in 2022. Earlier this week, UBS analyst Joseph Spak cut his rating on Ford to hold from buy over concern that its EV strategy will be slow to pay off. Though we like CEO Farley's vision and direction for the future of Ford, we believe it could take a number of years for the benefits of those plans to be realized, Spak wrote in a note to investors. Again, the title of that posted to Bloomberg, Ford Cuts Workforce, Making Electric F-150s on Weak Demand. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, Investors Flock to Gold on Geopolitical Risks, Fed Rate Cut Bets. Producer Price Index unexpectedly declined in December. Geopolitical concerns from airstrikes boost haven demand. This by Yvonne Yu Lee was posted on Friday, January 11th, 2024. Gold jumped the most in a month after soft U.S. producer prices data amped up expectations of interest rate cuts. While U.S.-led airstrikes on Houthi rebel targets in Yemen stoked haven demand, prices paid to U.S. producers unexpectedly fell in December for a third straight month, consistent with limited inflation at the wholesale level, Labor Department data showed Friday. The Houthi response to the U.S. and U.K. airstrikes is imminent, a senior political leader and member of ruling party Mohammed Ali al-Houthi said in a public speech. Treasury yields and the dollar weakened after the PPI report, while latest comments from the Houthi leader signaled a potential escalation of the situation in the Middle East. Those developments boosted bullion by as much as 1.6%, the biggest intraday jump in a month. Investors typically seek haven in gold in times of geopolitical and economic uncertainty. At the same time, they want to own the precious metal in a rate-cutting cycle. Bullion usually has an inverted relationship with rates. The lower the rates, the higher it climbs. While recent U.S. economic data point to a bumpy path ahead for policymakers trying to bring down inflation to a 2% target, traders appear to be focused on the timing and size of the Federal Reserve's shift to lowering borrowing costs. Despite daily price swings, bullion has stayed above the $2,000 an ounce level since December 13th, on expectations of the U.S. Central Bank's pivot to monetary easing. The U.S. and U.K. launched about 70 airstrikes on Houthi targets in Yemen early Friday in a bid to stop the Iran-backed group's shipping attacks in the Red Sea. The Houthis appear undeterred, vowing to continue targeting commercial vessels and saying they'd expand their campaign very soon. All U.S. and U.K. interests are now legitimate targets, the group said. Gold has responded to the increase in tensions, which clearly indicate that the West is slowly being drawn into the Middle East conflict, said Nikki Shields, head of metal strategy at Geneva-based MKS PAMP SA. It's another added support to gold, she said. Gold rose 1.3% to $2,055.49 an ounce as of 10:36 Friday in the morning in New York. This article is posted to Bloomberg. The title, Interest Rate Cuts Aren't Good News for Profit Forecasts, History Shows. An economic slowdown could lead to lower corporate earnings. Bullish forecasts may be calm before the storm, Sokgen says. This was posted on January 15, 2024 by Michael Sicca. Equity markets have been rising in tandem with corporate profit estimates, buoyed by a resilient economy. But if history is any guide, looming interest rate cuts may flip the script. While markets have been eagerly anticipating rates coming down, that may not actually be a good thing for company earnings. Typically, the Federal Reserve cuts rates when the economy is heading for a recession, something that analysts' optimistic projections don't seem to be accounting for. In the United States, some see the Fed's cutting as soon as March, as inflation and producer prices are trending broadly lower. Declining profits and interest rates tend to go hand in hand, Societe Generale SA's Andrew Lapthorne said. Current estimates reflect a very rosy outlook, the quantitative strategists wrote in a note. Is this the calm before the storm? Global stocks have been on a tear over the past year, soaring about 16%, supported by rising earnings forecasts. Margins are hovering near record highs. Analysts have continued to lift estimates. UBS Group AG strategist Jerry Fowler said the market has benefited from lower than expected inflation, which allowed bond and equity valuations to expand. From here, quote, either earnings estimates are revised lower and prices move lower to reflect that, or interest rate cuts are priced out and prices fall as multiples compress, said Kyle Roda, senior market analyst at Capital.com. Looking ahead, the consensus view is still very bullish, with blended forward 12-month earnings for the MSCI World Index expected to surge 10% this year, followed by more than 8% growth in 2025, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Early indications from companies have been mixed. Burberry Group, PLC, slumped last week after the UK trench coat maker slashed its profit forecast, a fresh sign that demand for luxury goods is waning. And in December, FedEx Corp's shares tumbled after an earnings report that exposed weakness at the company's express air business, with customers opting to send packages by a slower, less expensive mode of transport. Still, Lululemon Athletica Incorporated, Abercrombie & Fitch, both raised their sales outlooks this month on the back of a strong holiday quarter, bucking fears of consumer weakness amid stubbornly high inflation. So far, with soft landing expectations being unchallenged by a still strong U.S. job market and consumer spending, companies are expected to sustain robust earnings growth, particularly in the technology sector. In Europe, firms are also seen keeping pace this year with 12% growth over the next 12 months. Negative profit revisions ahead of the fourth quarter earnings season have not altered the broadly upward trend of earning estimates. Earning headwinds remain underappreciated, Fowler said. We still think that weaker inflation and nominal GDP growth put margins at risk. Again, the title of that at Bloomberg, interest rate cuts aren't good news for profit forecasts, history shows. This article is posted to CNBC. The title, FAA says it will audit Boeing's production line after 737 MAX 9 accident. This was published on Friday, January 12, 2024. Key points. The FAA said it will audit Boeing's production line after a door plug blew out on an Alaska Airlines 737 MAX 9 a week ago. The agency said it is considering the use of an independent third party to oversee Boeing's inspections and quality. The FAA grounded more than 170 Boeing 737 MAX 9s, most of the world's fleet, after that incident. Here's the story. The Federal Aviation Administration on Friday said it will audit Boeing's production line a week after a door plug flew off an Alaska Airlines 737 MAX 9. The agency said it is considering using an independent third party to oversee Boeing's inspections and quality of its manufacturing. The FAA grounded more than 170 Boeing 737 MAX 9s, most of the world's fleet, after the incident. The agency said the audit applies to Boeing's production line for the plane model and its suppliers, quote, to evaluate Boeing's compliance with its approved quality procedures, end quote. The results of the FAA audit analysts' analysis will determine whether additional audits are necessary, the agency said. The FAA said it will also evaluate risks around Boeing's ability to self-monitor quality control and other aspects of airplane production. The agency on Thursday announced an investigation into whether the manufacturer failed to ensure its planes were airworthy and conformed to their design. The grounding of the 737-9 and the multiple production-related issues identified in recent years require us to look at every option to reduce risk, FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker said in a statement. Earlier this week, Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun told staff the company acknowledges its quote-unquote mistake and said it would move past the incident, the latest defect and the most serious in recent years from Boeing. No serious injuries were reported on the Alaska Airlines flight. No one was seated next to the panel that blew out, nor in the next seat over. Still, the incident ramps up scrutiny on Boeing's quality problems and on regulators that oversee the industry. The FAA conducts final safety checks and issues airworthiness certificates for newly produced Boeing 737s, the agency said. This article is posted to Fortune. The title, Citigroup to Cut 20,000 Jobs, Take Up to $1 Billion Charge as CEO Jane Fraser Vows 2024 will be a turning point. It's written by Todd Gillespie and Bloomberg News and posted on Friday, January 12, 2024. Citigroup Incorporated said it will eliminate 20,000 roles in a move that will save it as much as $2.5 billion as part of Chief Executive Officer Jane Fraser's quest to boost the Wall Street giant's lagging returns. Firm-wide expenses are expected to drop to a range of $51 billion to $53 billion over the medium term, Citigroup said, without clarifying the exact time frame. In the meantime, though, the firm expects to incur as much as $1 billion in expenses tied to severance payments and Fraser's broader overhaul of the bank. Costs for the year should be in the range of $53.5 billion to $53.8 billion, a decrease from $56.4 billion the firm spent in 2023. The outlook for cost savings helped mask a disappointing fourth quarter when Citigroup's fixed income traders turned in their worst performance in 5 years as the rates and currencies business was stung by a slump in client activity in the final weeks of the year. Revenue from the business slumped 25% to $2.6 billion. The fourth quarter was very disappointing, Fraser said in the statement. Given how far we are down the path of our simplification and divestitures, 2024 will be a turning point, she said. Fraser, in September, initiated the biggest restructuring of Citigroup in decades as she seeks to improve the bank's returns. She has said the moves will allow the bank to eliminate bureaucracy, slimming it down from 13 management layers to just 8. Fraser has also said the overhaul would help her boost a key measure of profitability known as return on tangible common equity to at least 11% by 2027 at the latest. She reiterated that medium-term guidance on Friday. The 20,000 roles that Citigroup will eliminate include jobs cut as part of the restructuring as well as dismissals that would have occurred anyway. Citigroup's quarterly results swung to a $1.8 billion loss, or $1.16 a share. That included a number of one-time items, including a $780 million charge tied to the severance the bank offered to employees impacted by the restructuring. The company also recorded a $1.7 billion charge to operating expenses in the quarter to cover a special assessment to replenish the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp's coffers after a series of bank collapses last year. Again, the title, Citigroup to Cut 20,000 Jobs, Take Up to $1 billion Charge as CEO Jane Fraser Vows 2024 Will Be a Turning Point. This article is posted to Education Week. The title, a few years ago, 8 states required personal finance education. Now it's up to half. This was written by Elizabeth Hubeck, posted on January 11, 2024. How many high school students have sat in a required math class and asked themselves, will I ever use, fill in the blank, in my daily life? In 2020, Forbes posed a similar question about algebra, trigonometry, and calculus to 900 Freakonomics podcast listeners. Fewer than 12% reported using lessons from any of these particular high school math classes in their daily lives. Now insert personal finance skills into that sentence. Anyone thinking about purchasing a car or home, taking on a student loan, obtaining a credit card, debating whether to eat out or make a meal at home, or making any other decision related to one's personal finances, might respond in the affirmative. But statistics indicate that many Americans lack the financial literacy to make informed decisions related to personal finances. More than one-third of American adults report having more credit card debt than emergency savings. 68% doubt they could cover 1 month of living expenses if they lost their primary source of income. And 25% report having no trusted source of financial guidance, according to Annuity.org and Bankrate's 2023 Annual Emergency Savings Report. Despite the data pointing to a lack of financial literacy, there is reason to believe that future generations of American adults will have a stronger grasp of the subject. That's because of a recent flurry of state legislation aimed at increasing the financial literacy of high school students. Pennsylvania this past December became the 25th state to pass a bill requiring a personal finance course for high school students. The number of U.S. states committing to improving teenagers' financial literacy has more than tripled since 2021. "We've gone from 8 to 25 states in the last 2.5 years, said Tim Renzetta, a co-founder of Next Gen Personal Finance, a nonprofit that provides free resources to educators and advocates for financial literacy education. John Pelletier, director of the Center for Financial Literacy at Champlain College and the author of an annual report on the topic, puts the recent growth into perspective. In 5 short years, more than 4 out of 10 U.S. high school students will be enrolled in schools where a standalone, full-semester course in personal finance is required before graduating," he said. That's a 229% increase from 2017. Pelletier is among several financial experts who say the pandemic is a primary impetus for states' sudden interest in financial literacy curricula. "It was a wake-up call," he said, noting how the pandemic exposed the country's widespread financial fragility, from individual households to businesses. Advocates for including financial literacy in K-12 education say the new requirements can't come soon enough. "High school students may not have the same degree of financial responsibility that adults do, but some are in a position to begin exhibiting some serious buying power. 18 is the legal age to apply for a credit card. Teenage students also can apply for student loans for college. Students who take a personal finance course that covers earning income, spending, saving, investing, and managing credit, topics approved by the National Standards for Personal Finance Education, tend to make better borrowing decisions, according to government reports. Further, financial education has been shown to help young people better manage cash flow and pay bills on time, according to the Center for Financial Security. Schools are the most likely and logical place for teens to learn about personal finance, say experts. And as most personal finance courses are being proposed as semester-long standalones, they will likely replace electives of equal length. "If we don't teach them in school, they'll learn on social media," Renzetta said. Some, but not all, of these financial influencers, referred to as finfluencers, provide sound financial information, he observed. Others may profit from the advice they share. Some have questioned why students don't rely on parents to teach them about finances. But not all adults have a strong sense of financial literacy, and in many households, personal finance remains a taboo topic, with parents uncomfortable sharing information about their own finances and the decisions influencing them, explained Carrie Harold, a teacher who has taught personal finance at Wisconsin's DePere High School for almost 2 decades. She calls it her proudest teaching accomplishment. "Students don't know what they don't know," she said. "When they do know better, they can do better." That applies to all students, said Harold, from those normally engaged in class to those who tend not to see the value of education. Their brains may not work the same as our K-12 system, she said, and when they hear about this financial stuff, they're like, finally, something I can use. Elizabeth Hubeck is a staff writer for Education Week. And again, the title of that, a few years ago, 8 states required personal finance education. Now it's up to half. You're listening to Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. I'm listener-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. This article is posted to Bloomberg, the title, Traders Dust Off 2000's Options Playbook to Cash In on Higher Rates. Strategy uses deep-in-the-money puts to make low-risk cash. CBOE says the trade is twice as common as it was 3 years ago. This was written by Carly Wana and posted on Friday, January 19th, 2024. Citigroup Incorporated's option volume was light on a recent Wednesday until the session's last 90 minutes when a wave of trades hit. These weren't bets on the shares moving. Rather, they were part of a long-dormant strategy that's back in vogue thanks to the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. The trade involves selling large volumes of put options that allow the holder to offload shares far above the current market value and collecting interest on the premium received. It was pointless back when interest rates were near zero, but now the Treasury yields at 5% or more, the strategy is suddenly worthwhile. Nobody did this for 20 years because there wasn't any interest rates, said Joe Mazzola, Director of Trading and Education at Charles Schwab & Company. Interest rates are back. It makes sense, he said. The strategy is largely used by large institutional players, trading thousands at a time to make half a penny, Mazzola said. Mom and pop don't do this. According to data from CBOE Global Markets Incorporated, these financing trades are taking place twice as often as they did just 3 years ago. The exchange operator pointed to repeated rate tightening as one reason traders have dusted off their old playbooks. It's an example of how traders have adjusted or readjusted to a higher interest rate environment after years of near zero rates. While these low-risk, high-volume plays have little impact on the market's daily moves, they're frequent enough now to at times distort one of the most common measures of equities sentiment, the put-call ratio, particularly when it comes to individual stocks. Analysts often cite the put-call ratio as a gauge of investor caution, with higher volumes of puts signaling bearishness. The put-call ratio has spiked overall, but if you look at the money out of the money options, you see it's not doing anything, said Henry Schwartz, global head of client engagement at CBOE. The deep-in-the-money puts are inflating the volumes, he said. Here's how the trade appears to have gone on November 8th. Trader A bought 15,000 Citigroup Incorporated $55 puts and sold the same number of $50 puts with Trader B, getting the right to sell shares at $55 and the obligation to buy them at $50. U.S. stock options are mostly American style, meaning options buyers can exercise their rights anytime before expiration. So on that same day, both traders exercised the option they bought 72 days ahead of expiration. Seems pointless, right? Well, perhaps not, since there are other positions open in the $50 put Trader A sold. They may not have to buy all those shares. Options assignment happens randomly through the exchange, so even though Trader B exercised their position, other options holders have not. The higher the open interest for a given contract, the greater the odds of not being assigned. In this case, the $55 and $50 puts had 12,000 and 20,600 contracts outstanding, respectively, before the trade. Trader A can earn interest on the premium until they're eventually assigned the option. With three-month Treasury bills yielding some 5.3% when the trade took place, that could be as much as $160,000 if the options aren't assigned until expiry, barring major moves in the shares that bring the options back into play. Higher interest rates mean that the gain for the put from the long option holder not optimally exercising is higher. So instead of, say, making 1/100th of a cent per day per contract, basically nothing, it's possible to make 1 cent per day per contract, said John Zhu, head of U.S. trading at market-making firm Optiver. If done enough times, then it's possible to make some money from that. One other quirk. These trades generally happen on Wednesday. Since options that are exercised take 2 days to settle, a contract exercised midweek will settle on Friday, providing the entire weekend of funding, according to Alex Kosogligodov, managing director of equity derivatives at Nomura Securities International. For that reason, put call ratios midweek might be particularly distorted, he said. Another trigger for the trade is declining stock valuations. Data from CBOE shows that the trade bounced back in 2022 and then faded at the beginning of 2023 amid an unexpected tech-led rally. According to CBOE's Schwartz, sinking share prices led to high open interest on the deep in the money contracts. Some choose not to exercise due to, quote, transaction costs and tax considerations, end quote, Schwartz said. It's so deep in the money that it's not really much of an option anymore. It's just holding the money, he said. There's reason to believe the trade might continue in 2024. The market is full of optimism that the Fed will lower rates, but borrowing costs will stay elevated for some time, providing ample opportunity to pick up a bit of extra cash. According to Steve Sosnick, chief strategist at Interactive Brokers, the strategy does not generally occur in other countries and results from quirks in U.S. trading rules. It's unlikely that will change anytime soon. Those who engage in the practice fight hard to keep it, he said. It's hard to discern how the general public is affected by it, he said. And the title of that Trader's Dust Off 2000s Options Playbook to Cash In on Higher Rates. This article is posted to CNBC, the title, How to Negotiate a Real Estate Commission When Selling Your House. Lowering the commission can put more money in your pocket. This was published on Thursday, January 18, 2024, was written by Anna Staples. Selling your home is a large transaction that can involve a lot of negotiation. That doesn't only include talking the price and other terms with a potential buyer. You can also negotiate with your real estate agent. If you're successful, you can close the deal with more money in your pocket. And considering home prices, the amount can be significant. Here's what you need to know about real estate commissions. How does the real estate commission work? A real estate commission is a fee the home seller pays at closing to the buyers and sellers' agents. The typical commission rate is 5 to 6%, and it's split evenly between the two agents and the companies they work for. The seller pays out the money when the deal closes. Since it can be a considerable sum, sellers usually include the percentage they'll lose to the commission in the asking price. According to Julie Felsman, branch manager and SVP of mortgage lending at online marketplace Guaranteed Rate, even appraisers are required to consider selling concessions when determining property valuations and that includes agents' commissions. Ultimately, I think we can all agree that the only person bringing money to the table on the closing of a home purchase is, in fact, the buyer, she says. The buyer is, has been, and always will be paying for everything. In rare situations, such as with a bank-owned property, a listing will indicate that only a portion of the buyer's agent commission will be covered by the seller. However, even in these scenarios, the buyer's agent often opts out of additional payments from their client. Are real estate commissions negotiable? The property's price isn't the only negotiable thing in a real estate transaction. As a seller, you may be able to negotiate your agent's commission as well. However, not many people exercise this opportunity. According to the 2023 data from the NAR, only 22% of sellers brought up the topic of commission fees, and the real estate agent was willing to negotiate. Another 5% also initiated the discussions, but the agent was not able or willing to negotiate their rates. Negotiation doesn't happen that often, says Aja McClanahan, a licensed realtor in Florida. Seems like the consumer isn't always aware of their ability to negotiate their commissions and some of the fees, she said. Indeed, 15% of recent home sellers did not know commission rates could be negotiated. That said, if you do want to bring up the topic, it's best to do so as you're interviewing prospective agents. Learning about their marketing practices, level of experience in your local market, and what they can bring to the table are key. This way you'll know what you'll be paying for, and you can begin the negotiation process there. How to negotiate with a real estate agent? You're aware of what a real estate agent is offering you, but to successfully bring their rate down, you need to have something to offer as well. Here are some examples of what that might be. Multiple properties. According to McClanahan, volume helps, meaning if you can help the agent close on more than one property, they may be willing to bring down their rate. For example, if you're selling a home and buying another one, you can use the same agent for both transactions and negotiate their rates. Note that not all agents work as both a listing and buyer's agent, so make sure you ask before assuming they do. The more properties are involved, the better. For instance, this tactic can work for sellers if they have a deal where they're like, "Hey, can you help me buy a home for myself and my son?" McClanahan said, or maybe they can bring a referral. The same applies if you have multiple listing opportunities as a real estate investor. High-value properties. Even if you only have one property to offer, you can still make the case to lower the commission. Specifically, the listing agent may be open to negotiation if your home is in a sought-after area or highly valued. For example, it could help if you're listing a house priced at $2 million or more, because the commission will be so high, you will have a lot of wiggle room, McClanahan explains. Willingness to work with a newer agent. Even if you can't help your agent close multiple deals, there's still a chance they will be willing to negotiate with you. This will more likely be the case if you're working with a less established agent. A popular professional who's been in the industry for many years might have a long list of home sellers they're helping. A less experienced agent, on the other hand, might be working to increase their client volume and jump at the opportunity to close more transactions, even at a lower commission rate. And finally, remember that commission isn't the only thing you can negotiate. Real estate agents may also charge transaction fees. A lot of agents charge those, McClanahan said. Sometimes buyers and sellers are not necessarily aware of that, so it's a good idea to ask your realtor. Transaction fees are administrative costs associated with closing a sale and can total a few hundred dollars. You can always try to ask about lowering or even waiving these fees if negotiating the commission does not prove fruitful. Bottom line, a home sale is a large transaction. Even though your agent commission is a small part of it, it can amount to tens of thousands of dollars. Luckily, you can always try to negotiate. Remember that even if you aren't selling a high-value property or can't help the agent close on multiple properties, it never hurts to ask. The only time it's guaranteed you'll fail at negotiation is when you don't start it. Again, the title of that, How to Negotiate a Real Estate Commission When Selling Your House. It's posted to CNBC. This article is posted to The Motley Fool. Title is Spousal Social Security Benefits, Three Things All Retired Couples Should Know. This was written by Stefan Walters and posted on January 14, 2024. Key points. Spouses can receive up to 50% of their partner's Social Security benefits. Claiming spousal benefits before full retirement age reduces how much you receive, and spousal benefits convert to survivor's benefits when your partner passes away. Here's the article. Spousal Social Security benefits can be an important part of retirement planning, so retirees want to be as knowledgeable as possible. Social Security has been one of the most important social programs in the U.S. for decades. For retirement specifically, it provides vital income to millions of Americans across the country. After years of paying Social Security taxes, beneficiaries reap the rewards with a financial safety net of sorts. However, these benefits aren't restricted only to people who worked and paid taxes over the years. For example, Social Security allows spousal benefits to support non-working or low-earning spouses in retirement. For any couple that is nearing or in retirement and putting financial plans in place, here are three things they should know about Social Security spousal benefits. 1. How Social Security spousal benefits work. Social Security typically calculates a recipient's monthly benefits using a formula that factors in their 35 highest earning years of income. But a spouse can receive Social Security benefits based on their partner's earning record if they're at least 62 years old or caring for a child under 16 or with a disability. Assuming the person claiming spousal benefits is at full retirement age, they're eligible to receive 50% of their spouse's primary insurance amount, too. For example, if spouse A's earnings record gives them a monthly benefit of $2,000 at their full retirement age, spouse B could receive up to $1,000 monthly as well. The exact amount will depend on the age at which the spouse B claims benefits. 2. The impact of claiming benefits early or late. Your full retirement age is one of the most important numbers related to Social Security because it tells you when you're eligible to receive your primary insurance amount. However, you don't have to claim benefits at your full retirement age. You can claim them early, which reduces your payout, or delay, which increases your payout. Claiming Social Security benefits early affects a spouse and their partner receiving spousal benefits in different ways. Looking first at the person claiming based on their work record, their benefits are reduced by 0.5% each month before their full retirement age, up to 36 months. Each month after that further reduces benefits by 0.5%. Here's an example. Someone with a full retirement age of 67 who claims benefits at 62 will see their monthly benefit reduced 30% from their primary insurance amount. For the person receiving spousal benefits, benefits are reduced by 0.25% each month before their full retirement age, up to 36 months, and they then go down 0.5% each month thereafter. So a person with the same full retirement age, 67, claiming spousal benefits at 62, would see their checks reduced by 35%. Although benefits typically increase if you wait beyond your full retirement age, these delayed retirement credits don't apply to spousal benefits. And 3, what happens if a spouse passes away? Social Security spousal and survivor's benefits can be closely linked, as the latter extends critical financial assistance after a partner has passed away. If you're claiming spousal benefits when your partner passes away, Social Security will convert your spousal benefits to survivor's benefits. Survivor's benefits make you eligible to receive up to 100% of your deceased spouse's benefit, including any delayed retirement credits they earned prior to their passing. A widow or widower can begin receiving survivor's benefits at age 60, 50 if dealing with a disability, but as in the case with spousal benefits, they'll be reduced if claimed before full retirement age. You can't simultaneously receive spousal and survivor's benefits, only whichever is higher. Since spousal benefits max out at 50% of the partner's primary insurance amount, survivor's benefits are typically the higher paying option. Again, the title of that article, Spousal Social Security Benefits, Three Things All Retired Couples Should Know. That's posted to themotleyfool.com. This article is posted to CNBC. The title, Bitcoin ETFs Have a Key Difference from Their Stock Fund Counterparts. This was published on Friday, January 12, 2024. It was written by Jesse Pound. Key points. The Bitcoin funds that launched Thursday are using a share redemption process that turns the underlying crypto into cash. While the rules around share redemption do not directly affect the smaller trades that retail investors do in brokerage accounts, they come into play for the execution of larger trades made by institutions. Here's the story. U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission pushed for Bitcoin exchange-traded funds to have a key difference from major stock funds. And that decision's effect on how the funds trade will only become clear over time. The Bitcoin funds that launched Thursday are using a share redemption process that turns the underlying crypto into cash. Most ETFs primarily use an in-kind redemption process where the underlying asset does not have to be actually sold. While the rules around share redemption do not directly affect the smaller trades that retail investors do in brokerage accounts, they come into play for the execution of larger trades made by institutions. There's some concern that using the cash-only redemption model could make the plumbing of the ETFs less efficient. It could be that certain funds are capable of getting better execution prices than others. The other thing is that those trading costs, whether it be transaction costs or the market impact type costs that aren't necessarily quantifiable, those costs are now borne by investors, said Brian Armour, director of Passive Strategies Research for North America at Morningstar. In-kind redemptions are typically used by major equity funds, and as crypto asset manager Grayscale pointed out in a presentation to the SEC, commodities funds. Using cash-only redemption could result in ETFs that have weaker liquidity and wider bid-ask spreads, Grayscale argued. But Stephen McClurg, chief investment officer at Valkyrie, said the situation may be more analogous to fixed income ETFs, where cash redemption is more common because the authorized market participants working with the funds may be more comfortable with the process. In this situation, he said, there's a lot of APs that don't have the ability to transact in Bitcoin. If it was an in-kind model, then it would throw a lot of advantage toward the APs that do have that ability. We want as many market makers and authorized participants in these products as possible because that makes for better markets, McClurg said. From a regulatory perspective, the decision to only allow cash redemptions simplifies the chain of custody for Bitcoin and removes broker-dealers from the process, said Jeremy Senderowitz, an attorney and shareholder at Vedder Price, a firm that specializes in ETFs. SEC Chair Gary Gensler said in a statement Wednesday that broker-dealers are still expected to follow best interest regulations with regard to crypto products, a potential sign that the SEC is wary of those firms becoming directly involved with these funds. The good news for investors is that the cash redemption process should not change the tax treatment of the funds, even though cash redemptions are more generally associated with mutual funds than ETFs. Many investors and financial advisors choose to use ETFs because the funds give them more control over when to create tax events. These things are taxed as grantor trusts. Consensus is that when an AP is redeemed for cash, the tax consequences only accrue to the AP. So it's not like cash redemptions on mutual funds and regular 40 Act ETFs, where to the extent that it's a cash transaction, taxable income stemming from fund transaction is passed through to all the shareholders, Senderowitz said. Again, the title of that article posted to CNBC, Bitcoin ETFs have a key difference from their stock fund counterparts. Business World, a weekly program focusing on personal finance, retirement planning, and developments affecting the global economy. I'm listener-supported Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Mike Amy. Thank you for listening.